Welcome to Tips from the Server Room. This podcast is designed for all you systems admins, network specialists, or the guys and gals out there in the office who handles it all. Sit back, relax, grab a beverage, and enjoy Tips from the Server Room. Hey, yes, welcome back, everybody, once again to Tips from the Server Room. This is episode number 64 for September the 23rd, 2014. I'm your host, Jack, and I'm going to help guide you through this magical world of networks, technology, servers, fiber, and all things connected. Folks, this show is a proud member of the Tech Podcast community. If it's tech, it's here. Please check out all the great technology shows at techpodcast.com. That's techpodcast.com. If you'd like to comment on these shows, and I hope that you would, you want to go to tipsfromtheserveroom.com and you'll find the shows there, all the different podcasts that I've created, the different episodes, where you can simply click on comment, leave me a comment there. You can also leave me a voice message, which we have a few tonight that we're going to be playing for you. You can simply call 724-701-0550. That's 724-701-0550. And if you're a little bit adventurous, I think maybe, and I'm not sure how that works, but I think Skype, if you Skype the name Jack's Tech Corner and you're using Skype, I think you can also leave a voice message there. So if you're worried about a toll call or something, I don't know how your part of the world works. Most phone calls anymore is pretty much, across the states, it's pretty much free anymore. So there's really no long-distance companies that I know about. If you have any questions or ideas for future shows, I'd like to hear from you. You can simply email me at jackstechcorner@gmail.com. You can follow me at Twitter and as at Technoman. As I said there, we have a few voice messages tonight, and I'm going to try to play those. I think I got everything set up right where I can be recording the voice message as it's being played. So we're going to try this. The first voice message is from a listener by the name of Josh. Josh, thank you so much for sending this in. And he's having some trouble and some issues with Windows Server 2012 with some file shares, and we're going to talk about that. And actually found some information that might help us out to understand maybe what's going on. And we did have this same issue in our network when we were rolling out a 2012 server. So let's go ahead and listen in to Josh here and his message.
Hey, Jack. This is Josh, Scoville Technologies from Macon, Georgia. And I also work full-time for school system during the day. And have a question for you. Provisioned a Server 2012 server, a couple of them, over the summer. One of them we're using for an application server. And I just wonder, is there anything funny that you know about going on with permissions? We've had this happen a couple times. Once recently, just this Friday, things are rocking along fine. We've got schools set up as individual shares on the server with individual permissions for their users at each school. And I had two separate people call me Friday afternoon from two separate schools saying, I can no longer connect and put stuff in a folder on the share on the apps drive. And it practically about the same time. And I just wonder, is there anything kind of funny that you know going on with the way 2012 handles permissions, share permissions, and folder permissions? That I need to kind of look out for and see. You're just trying to figure out what may be going on as far as, it's just kind of weird for two different users on two different shares to be having the same problem at the same time when things had been working fine, for several weeks now. Anyway, just wanted to leave you a message and get your thoughts on that. You can call me or email me would be the best way probably at josh@scovilletech, scovilletech.com. Or just play it on the show and talk about it there if you want to, whatever you want to do. But anyway, I thought I'd call you and leave you a message and question, something to ponder. Thank you. Have a good day. Enjoy the show.
Okay, very good, Josh. Well, thank you very much for that message there. And we definitely are going to talk about this a little bit, because this happened to us also, and it happened in actually two different types of situations. The first situation, I don't know what you're using on the workstations. You didn't really elaborate on that. But I'm going to tell you on our perspective, we found when we were running Windows XP, we had a lot of users, just like you, when we created file shares on the Windows Server 2012, where they were giving us the same thing. In the morning, they would log on, and it may work. It may be absolutely fine. They'd get to their file shares, and everything was going well. And then later on through the day, for whatever reason, that kind of broke the connection. And it started to dawn on me, or I started thinking a little bit about the server 2012. And one thing that spiked my interest was, is the server actually putting the NIC, for some reason, server 2012 actually shutting down a network card? And then the more I thought about that, the more I thought, man, that would be really bad, or really a big flaw, right? If Microsoft would shut our network cards down if they weren't seeing any traffic, and then kind of wake on LAN as that traffic hit again. So I thought, that's probably not the case. Now, I did find an article here, and I'm going to post it in the show notes. You can read it also. It is actually from Spiceworks. If you're not familiar with Spiceworks, it's a... I don't really know what this site, the community Spiceworks, but Spiceworks makes, you know, this great free package where we can audit our computers and do all this great stuff with it. Just throw it up on a server. It's all web-based. It works pretty well. We've played with it before. But they said they were having the same trouble, and they were talking about Windows Server 2012 R2, and they've been playing around with it for several months, and initially they were having some issues with the XP Pro PCs that seemed to have an issue with it. And they were feeling that whenever they called the server name, they were getting a permissions denied. And it seems like there's a whole different set of networking instructions between Windows XP and Windows Server 2012. Against their TCP IP stacks, or their permission settings, they're not talking properly. And a few weeks ago, we talked about permissions and setting up different permissions on servers. And they're talking about the Kerberos events. I'm sure you can pronounce that a lot better than me. But anyway, they did the same thing we did. We suspected that there was a patch out for Windows XP, and I dug around tonight after listening to your voicemail, and I was trying to find the patch. So what we decided to do was we actually just upgraded all those computers to Windows 7, and we never had any more issues. All the issues went away. So I don't believe it's server-based. I don't think it's any problem with your permissions. It might be more of a problem with the client computer that you're hooking to that actual server. And again, you didn't really elaborate on what the clients are, and that's okay. It's just something for you to think about. I really don't know why any other way to elaborate on that. You know, something else you'd want to try is log into that computer as an administrator, a domain administrator account, and play around with a folder and see what kind of issues you have, if any. You're going to have to set up a little test environment, maybe in your office or something, and see if your connection ever drops to that server. And, you know, because we're trying to determine, is it the server that's giving you the issue? Is it something there? Is a server virtualized? Did you roll out a virtualized server? Is it something in the virtualization settings? Or is it, in fact, the workstation and what's going on there? If you find out that it's working fine on the administrator's account, which is naturally, we know, the highest level permissions that we can basically get on a server, you know, we have full access to everything, then that might be something you'd want to dig around and find out, okay, maybe we need to change the user's permissions a little bit more and give them a little bit more permissions. Another thing you can try, just out of the back of my head thinking about this a little bit, what we would probably do is bring a different laptop into that user and say, hey, log on this laptop onto the domain, bring up your file shares and see if you can copy folders in, you know, copy files in, add some text files, take them out, delete them. And if that's the case, then maybe we can drill it down just to the workstation itself. You know, when you look at the big picture, and a lot of times as technologists, we try to sit back and we look at the big overall picture and say, look, what is going on with this system? And we start looking at that and scratching our head, trying to look at the big picture, where in reality, as technologists, what we need to do is start breaking it down to smaller pieces and look at each individual piece and see what piece is actually failing. Something else you might want to look at is, and I don't know if you had this trouble before you upgraded to 2012, maybe you're coming from 2003 or 2008, I'm not sure what you're coming from, but another thing you might want to think about is your switches. Is there something going on in that switch that's breaking that connection? And we had that problem before where it would break a connection to the computer. So it started out fine in the morning, and all of a sudden they might have lost their server drive. That's happened a few times. Or the server drive was still there, but when they double-clicked on it, said they didn't have permissions. It's because there was a network breakdown between them and our server. So that's something else to look at. And there's so many different pieces of that, Josh. I think you're on the right track, though, because you're calling the show and you're looking for help. So those are my suggestions that I would do. You know, try to break it down to smaller networking segments. Check your switches. Maybe plug your laptop in that switch and log on again as the administrator and see if you have any trouble. And you also want, like today I had a user in particular with a client that is occasionally getting a blue screen. I said, well, what are you doing before that blue screen happens? And she didn't quite remember what was going on or couldn't pinpoint it. So, you know, you have to try to pinpoint what times of the day is it happening, how often does it happen, and just go from there. So great, great question. And I hope that I might have led you in some kind of a path to kind of start playing around with that and start feeling your way around to see what's going on and try to get that issue resolved. If it is a Windows XP machine, though, I would upgrade it. Oh, and I told you guys, we had some trouble in the past with Windows Server 2012. And this is interesting. If you're running any Macs, any OS X operations in your clients, the remote desktop client will not connect to Windows Server 2012. They changed the security in a way that the Microsoft Windows, the remote desktop client on a Mac will not connect to Windows Server 2012. So we actually found another free program, and I don't have it right now, unfortunately, to tell you what it is. But it works fine, and we use it for all of our remote connections to our servers, our remote desktop connections from the Mac. So works very, very well. Okay, so this next voice message I have for you here is from my buddy Martin. As you remember, from the Geeksters, we talked a few weeks ago. He interviewed me, and it was a wonderful interview, great show. Martin wanted to chime in a little bit about DNS, how he uses DNS, and about how our DNS or my DNS is set up a little bit differently. So go ahead, Martin, take it away.
Good morning, Jack. This is Martin Abando from the Geeksters. Wanted to let you know that I have been really enjoying your show. You're coming up with some great topics. The last one on VPNs was really good. There's some clients that I have that already sent up some VPNs, so you just kind of filled in a little bit of questions that I had. Thank you very much for that information. I wanted to reference back a couple episodes ago where we had some discussion via email regarding DNS and records within the DNS. I think the confusion came from is that I have all my services externally and you have your services internally. And that just is something that we need to be, and as other techs need to be, aware of, is that you may have to make changes to your DNS depending on where your services reside. Like you have services internal, you need to point everything back. Where mine is external, I need to point everything back out. But great show, Jack. Keep up the good work. I'll talk to you later. Bye-bye.
Okay, and again, that was Martin from, obviously, he said the Geeksters, which is on the Podnuts network. And Martin, great, great topic again. Thank you so much for listening to the shows. And I'm glad, I just told my wife tonight at dinner, the one thing that I really enjoy about this show is that I'm talking to a lot of my peers out there, a lot of people that we all do the same thing, right? We, on a daily basis, we're working on servers, we're working on networks, we're working on client workstations. And we all get to do the same thing. And once a week on Tuesday nights, I get to sit here behind a microphone and like this tonight, getting to listen to these great voice messages and getting to give you some of my feedback. And I also get to give you a few new topics each week as I come across them. And let me back up a little bit. When I first started doing this show, I thought, wow, am I ever going to run out of stuff to talk about servers? But when I wrapped up the whole networking part of it and then adding the client package to it, can you really ever run out of something to talk about? Probably not. Now, Martin was talking about the DSN, and let me back up for a second. I'm glad that you enjoyed the VPN session. I'm glad that's been helping you out a little bit. Because, you know, VPNs are so critically important to get our remote workers into our network securely that if you don't have a VPN, you know, start investigating and play around with that. But you talked about DNS inside and outside and how your DNS servers are mostly outside. And I do have to call you one day, Martin. I've been trying to make some time to sit down to call you on the phone so we can discuss this stuff a little bit. Because I don't understand that part of it, so I'd like to talk a little bit more and try to clarify that to me so I can understand it. We have both in my network. I use an inside DNS and an outside DNS. And the reason I need the outside DNS is because I don't want all that traffic of the internet hitting my DNS to look for my zone records for our, you know, our stuff like email or web servers. And I don't want all that traffic coming into my network. So I do use an outside DNS, and I told you guys, I think before, I use Zone Edit because you can set up two zones for free, and a zone is basically that. It's just a set of two different domains, if you want to call it that, but zones, and you can put all your information in there, and then that way you point, I use that on my domain register and say, hey, that's my DNS server. So when everybody's looking for our pages or whatever we have to offer, they go there and they hit their stuff and they do it very well. And, you know, they've been doing it for years. Our internal DNS that I keep internally is for stuff like all of our clients, because all your clients need a DNS server so they can hook to your domain controller. I can't think of any other way to do that. They need a DNS server. So when the people go to log on your computer, it goes in and it looks at the, you know, internal DNS server. And that's why I want to talk to you, Martin, because I don't understand if you just have an outside, when a user goes to log in, and let's say they're 20 feet from the server room, if it's only outside, they have all their traffic has to go outside their network, out to the internet, decide where that's supposed to go, come back through the internet, come back in, and then hit the server, where the just having an internal DNS server, all that traffic is kept in your house, and it's a lot faster. So I do want to talk to you, and I do want to clarify that, and I bet from the interview we did, and you said we could probably talk for hours, I bet we can probably wrap a whole show around it, and we can just talk together, bang our heads together a little bit about DNS, and maybe clarify that out there for the other listeners to maybe put that together. Now, the thing is I wanted to mention out there is about using, and I think we talked about this before, about a primary and a secondary DNS service, and I don't know if people understand this or not, but I had some interns at one point, and they thought that we can go to the secondary server and log on to that because maybe it was easier to get on. I don't know why. An updated DNS record. Well, it will never propagate back up to the primary server. It's called primary for a reason. It holds the primary zones, the primary records, and that secondary DNS server, its job is to ask the primary, hey, is there any changes up there? Is there anything new that I need to know about or do or anything? So that is the stuff that the secondary DNS server does. So you always want to make your changes on the primary DNS server. And then it will be sent down to the secondary DNS server. Now, when you're we talked about already when you're only using an outside DNS server, how it won't copy to your inside server. I don't know how you would make that connection. If you could do that, I have successfully set up across the wide area network. You can do that because you're on the same subnet, you're on the same network. If you have two VPNs connected, your network together, and I can have a DNS server in one office, and I can have another office located in Guam if I want to, and it can have a DNS server, and the records will transmit across both of those individual servers across my VPN. It works extremely well. So, all right. So hopefully that clarifies that. Again, Martin, thank you for the great, great voicemail. I really do enjoy that. And folks, if you want to get those voicemails in, and please do. I mean, I'd like to have played you Martin's first one because, you know, it's interesting. I've called a couple shows. Like I've called the Mike Smith Tech Show a few times. And you start talking. You're like, okay, I'd like to first start talking about, and you might lose your train of thought. So just hang up and call back. And it's no big deal. I can delete it off the voice messages. I won't play it. And I've done that with the Mike Smith Tech Show. I mean, I called in, so I started, and it's like, oh, Mike, please delete this, and I'll call back. So But so, yeah, don't worry about messing up. You know, we all do it. You guys probably heard in my podcast at times where I might say something, and, you know, like mispronouncing a word. But, you know, to be a true podcaster, we leave that in there. We're not going to clean it up and scrub that for hours and make it sound studio perfect. We're podcasters. We're here to spread the joy of whatever we're talking about. So you're going to have a couple of mishaps, and that's okay. Folks, if you want to call that voice number, this is always like a telethon. If you want to call, get those calls in now and get your pledges going. No, don't, you don't have to pledge anything. Just call in. It's free. 724-701-0550. 724-701-0550. And I also post it with each show. So if you don't remember the number, you're driving in your car, don't get out a pencil and wreck, huh? Just keep driving and don't worry too much about that. And what I would suggest to do is go to tipsfromtheserveroom.com, look at any of the shows. I post it every week, and they're the phone number. And somebody said, well, Jack, why don't you just post it on your website? Because the reason I do that is when it gets pushed out to iTunes, if somebody don't come to my site, they still have my information on iTunes. And this next one's going to tell you that maybe I should be a little bit more freely posting my email address. This is an email I received, and for the life of me, I don't know why I did this. I'm going to try to pull it up here real quick because I, for some reason, didn't write down the name of the emailer. Let me see here if I got it. Oh, it's okay. So I got it now. And let me pull my notes back up. So this email is coming to you from a listener by the name of Jeff. Jeff, thank you so much for this email because this spiked my interest for the show tonight. This gave me a show topic for this evening. First, it starts out, I couldn't find an email address for you, so I am going to try to leave a comment here in the show topic. So he did. He left it on the actual show. I told you on tipsfromtheserveroom.com. He went in and left a comment. I wonder if you can offer some information on the murky waters of the Microsoft licensing model. Oh my God. This is a huge topic. We can probably talk for 20 days and 20 nights about Microsoft licensing and how they try to wrap you into a ball. Anyway, so this is still the email. What is the difference between volume licensing and buying standalone licenses? If I have a Windows 2012 server, what about my Windows 2003 CALS? What CALS, now if you don't know what a CAL is, it's a client access license, okay? So the CALS, do I need to access a terminal server via RDP? That's a great question, and we do that. Do I need just the TS, the terminal server CALS, the client access licenses, or do I need other types of client access licenses or CALS? If I'm accessing Microsoft Office applications? Well, that's a great question, and I'm going to give you my feelings on that. Now, what about the new SQL or SQL licensing model? Per processor or per user? You know, all that crazy stuff that Microsoft forces on you but doesn't explain the same way twice. What is a system analyst to do with this stuff? I hope this info provides you with some ideas. Thanks for the great shows. And Jeff, thank you for the great email. I told my wife at dinner and I said, I would have never even gave it a thought, and this is so important, but I would never gave it a thought before to bring this to a show. I just didn't, you know, really, I think so much about the connected parts and about the server parts and about the permissions and the DNS. I don't think a lot about the install part, and this is so critically important. First of all, there is a huge difference. You asked about what are you going to do with your Windows 2003 client access licenses? Well, that's called, what do they call that? Collateral damage. In other words, you paid for those, I'm sure, a long time ago, and they're probably like the server that they may be residing on. You're probably just going to retire those. You can't turn them in for a refund. You can't turn them in for an exchange. You can't turn them in and say, now I got the new server. I want to change my 2003s. To 2012s. Is that okay? Microsoft's going to say, no, thank you. Have a nice day. Because Microsoft is out there, folks, believe it or not, to make money. And they make a lot of money off of us, the Windows Server people. And you know how much server cost, how much SQL cost, how much Exchange cost, even how much Small Business Server cost. And I know they renamed it to something else, and I don't use it. But anyway, they make more money by volume off of network specialists or technology people or companies running the networks than they'll ever make off of the client workstation. Off of Windows 8, Windows 7, what Windows 9 is coming out, they're saying, oh, we might give it away for free. That doesn't matter. And the reason they give it away for free, folks, believe it or not, is they want us to upgrade. Here's what happens in any network, and then we're getting back to this question because I got a ton of information about this. But if you take Windows in your network right now, and if you're brave enough to do this, or silly enough, or just crazy enough maybe, you upgrade all your workstations to Windows 8.1 or 8.1.2 or whatever. I don't even know what there is out there today with 8, but I played with it. You know, I can use it, and I don't like it, but it is the way we're going, right? I think they're going to change it in Windows 9 or Windows whatever they're calling it, and they're going to bring back some of that familiar pieces that we know. But this is what happens, and I've seen it in our network. If you put it on a client workstation, chances are the client, the person using that, your office worker, your CAD worker, your finance people, when they buy a new computer, they're going to buy that on it. Microsoft makes more money. So yeah, they'll give it away for free, and they give it away for free because they know they're going to sell more systems, because the system prices will come down and they'll get more people. It's almost like a drug, right? You get addicted to Windows. And it's not even an addiction because there's so many pieces to it that you kind of get to that point where, you know, I guess it's what they know. Matter of fact, with one of my clients, I put him in front of a Mac as a loaner laptop. And they're like, oh my, how do I use this? I said, do you know what the Chrome icon looks like? Yep. Find it on a screen and click it, and you'll be fine. No problem. But yeah, it's like a drug. You not even that you get people addicted. I just think you get people monopolized into it. Okay, so we talked about that. The Microsoft Office part, and now I got to tell you, I don't really know. There's a lot of ways to look at it. There's play that and I don't want to turn you in the wrong direction, but the way I look at it, and we have a lot of terminal service client access licenses. And the reason we have a lot of terminal server client access licenses is because I do a lot of terminal service application presentation to my users. What I mean by that is it's easier for any of us to have one server with all your applications on it. And you can actually take that server and you can actually distribute different desktops to people with terminal services or remote desktop protocol. It's fantastic because when they call and they say, hey, I got a new application. Can you put this on my 30 laptops? Or can you put this on all my computers in the office? There's 225. Is it not easier just to put it on that server? And when they log in next time, it's there. It's available to them. So I believe, this is my belief, this is how we do it. If you buy a terminal service license, so you're going to terminal service somebody in there, Microsoft, the honest way they do it is with Microsoft Office, you're supposed to buy a licensed copy of Office for every user you have accessing that server. Now, you talked and you brought up a very good point, Jeff, about volume licensing versus standalone licensing. Standalone licensing traditionally used to get you, now I worked in an office recently that we found it does not, but it used to get you a CD, right? A CD media of the program, the Microsoft Office, let's say. Let's go with that. And that CD, you can load it supposedly one time. I understand now where it may be two times for a home user. And you have a vault, you have a key on the back. That key will work with one individual CD, one copy. Now, in saying that already, as I explained that to you, it costs more money to do it that way. Where if you buy volume licensing, now some places we're pretty lucky in my industry, and that is the reason that is because I can call and I can get five volume licensing. Because the industry I work in, they actually purchase through a consortium buy, they'll buy maybe 5,000 volume licensing, get a really, really good price. They push that back down to us. And if you work at nonprofits, there's also companies out there that will do that. And one is called, I can't remember it, soup.org. or something like that. Something soup dot something. Look it up for nonprofits to buy software. They do the same thing where they do a volume licensing consortium buy. So they buy a lot of these licenses. I can call them and say, I want 3 licenses, and I can get those because they're coming off that big group of licenses that they purchased. So they don't care. Their key works for all those licenses. And then what I do is I buy what's called the media CD or the media DVD. So they send me 1 DVD. I strip that down and put it on my server because, you know, you don't want to carry – how many people carry CDs and DVDs around with you? And I know a lot of people out there working in the tech field, especially if you're a consultant. I know, you know, I used to carry around some. I strip those all down now and put them on an external hard drive. Because we used to carry all the media around with us. We don't carry media around with us no more when we're working for clients. What I'd rather do is in a company, strip it down, put it on a server, on a share that you can get to, the administrator, and install from there. Put your key code on there also, or as I talked about a few shows back, dig around for a show, I think it was called Administrative Installs, and I teach you how to basically make a Microsoft install with all the key codes and everything in it. So when we hit setup, we can start to set up and walk away from the machine. We don't have to type the key in. We don't have to register. We don't have to do all that stuff anymore. It's all kind of built in there because I did an administrative install and put that in a folder. So, yes, volume licensing is a lot less expensive. Now, I don't know, and you might have to check somebody with your vendors, what the minimum amount of volume licensing you can buy. I don't think Microsoft has ever had a minimum amount to say, like, you got to buy 20. You know, if you want to save money, you got to buy more than you need. I don't think they do that. But if you're in an industry, if you're in a company, if not so much if you're consulting, because if you're consulting, I would be careful with that. Because when you buy a volume license, it's basically for the address where you are or for the company. So if the company was Campbell's Soup, Campbell's Soup may have businesses across the nation. I don't know where they're all at. But if the company itself buys that volume license, then you can put it pretty much anywhere you want. But if you work for Dr. A, Dr. B, Dr. C, and Dr. D, and they're not related to each other in any way, their offices are interconnected anyway, and you buy one volume license and you go out there and you put that on all those different companies, you know, you're making more money, obviously, because you're kind of, well, you are. You're just doing it illegally. You can't do that. Each doctor's office would have to have its own volume license. What I did with my doctor's offices, it was so much easier. They just went out and they bought the standalone licenses. And this brings you back to that point where, remember, you used to get the media with it? Well, you don't get the media with it anymore. You get this silly little card. You scratch off this number off the back. You type this number into a website, and then you can download the software. You better have a fast internet connection because it takes quite a long time to download Office. It's pretty big. Now, we talked about that. So let's go on here now, and I'm going to put this link in the show notes, Jeff. So go to the show, being show number 64, episode number 64 at tipsonserverroom.com. I'll have the link in there of where I pulled this from. And they talk a lot about the licensing aspects of it. I'm going to give you just – I'm going to let you read the top because you guys are all well-educated. You can read on your own. I don't need to read this all to everybody. But we're going to go down here a little bit, and I'm going to talk about some top client access license questions. And here, and this one struck me as interesting, and I just went over this with a vendor, and I said, look, we don't do that. Does a multifunction printer need a client access license? Yes. If the multifunction printer is connected to the Windows Server network, the printer access server software to receive an IP address, to receive a job, to communicate that job that is finished, etc. In short, if it communicates with the server software, then it needs a client access license. Now, we just went over this, and he said, the guy come in my office, and I'd like to get your feedback on this. He goes, they were selling us this software to monitor all the printers on the network to see who's printing and know how much people are printing, which is wonderful, and I think it's a great piece of software. He said, okay, Jack, where's your print server? I said, we don't have a print server. I never had a reason to set up a print server. So I said, I don't have a print server anywhere set up. So he goes, everybody has a print server. What are you doing here? What's wrong with your network? I said, wait a minute, bub. First of all, you're cutting down on my network. This is something I built, right? This is, you know, I always said, I build it, they shall come, right? Remember that? The field of dreams, if you build it, they shall come. And my network's pretty solid. I mean, to the point where, you know, it runs well. I don't have a print server. You're coming down on me because I can't buy your software now. I've always set my printers up as IP printers. And when I install them on the individual computers, it's IP. And thank goodness I did, because I didn't know I needed a client access license. I never knew this. This show helps to educate me as much as it's helping to educate you folks out there listening to it. Okay, here's another one. Do my servers need a client access license? Generally speaking, server-to-server communications do not require a client access license. However, servers used to pool connections, sometimes referred to as a multiplexing, does not reduce your CAL license requirements. If, for example, you have an application server, and you were talking about this, which uses SQL Server for its database, users of the application or the devices they use will need SQL client access license, even though they may not access the SQL server directly. If you use a Linux server and run a web server, but your users access that web server after being authenticated via a Windows server, then the users will need a Windows Server client access license. So any computer out there that you have that does a Control-Alt-Delete in the morning and they log into your server, they need to have a client access license. And I remember at one point, at least I'm going to pull this out of the back of my mind anyway, and I hope if I'm wrong, send me emails and say, Jack, you're off base. When 2008 Server was released, we were under the understanding that when you bought a Windows Server license, that Windows Server Pro license had the CAL pretty much packaged with it. So you're okay to connect that to your server. We've never had any trouble. We never had anything come up and say, hey, you're out of CAL licenses. We never had any issues with that. So I believe that to be the case. You did ask in your question, Jeff, about SQL and talked a little bit about user or processor. And by processors, you know, most servers have two. But sometimes what you got to watch, I know with VMware, what we ran into the issue with was they don't look at the processors, because if you have two processors, you're like, I got two. What they want to charge you for is the cores. So two processors, if it's quad core, that's eight cores you're paying for. So if I was going to license a server, let's say that SQLU was going to license it by core, and I had eight cores. If I had four users, you may be better off and be cheaper to pay for the four user access licenses. Now, if you believe your company is going to expand, which, you know, we always build our network for expandability purposes, if that would happen, then what you'd have to wonder is, I have four employees now. I have eight cores. Let me pay for the eight cores, because we may go to 16 employees in a couple months. And you don't want to pay for the, again, there's no trade-in program with Microsoft folks. They just don't do that. You can't, you call them up and say, hey, I got these. Can I trade these in? Or maybe can I upgrade my user licenses for core licenses? They're not going to do that for you. They're just not in that business. And I don't think they have that exchange program. So if you think you're going to expand your company, by all means, do that. Make sure that, you know, you buy exactly what you need and be careful. Now, you can always buy fewer cores. So maybe you want to run it on four cores now, quad core, and you can always upgrade to the other four cores later. I mean, you can also do that. So, you know, you got to work with Microsoft. And you, as you said, this stuff is, you can never get a straight answer twice. I'm trying to give you basically what rules we go by. Now, do my external users need a client access license? The general rule is all server software access requires a client access license. However, external users may have additional licensing options depending on the product. For example, with Windows Server, external users can be licensed with CALs or external connectors, whichever is more cost effective. External users access the application server, such as a SharePoint 2013. I don't know how many of you are using that. Link 2013 or Exchange 2013. I'm sure a lot of you are using Exchange. Remember, if you're using Exchange and your people are accessing that, there's a cost for that. So you have to buy a client access license. But is included with the server software. Client access licenses or external connectors may not require for external users for these products. Note, external users may need to be licensed appropriately for the underlying Windows Server operating systems and related software such as SQL. And a lot of people don't understand that. So if we have a Windows Server, you may have a client access for that Windows Server. If you load Microsoft Exchange on top of that, you may need a different access license for Microsoft Exchange. And I remember once that happened too, where they said, if you run Microsoft Exchange Server, folks, I haven't ran it for years, so I'm not really up on the setup of it, but I believe it was 2005 or 2008. And if you purchased the new Office with Microsoft Outlook, the Microsoft Outlook client came with or was said to have the client access license already built in. So if you're using the Outlook client, then you're okay. If you're trying to save money and you're using something like Thunderbird, then you had to pay for the client access license. Microsoft will get their money. That's what business they're in. They're in the business of making money, right? And you can't blame them. They have a lot of great engineers creating this great stuff that we use all the time, and I don't blame them for making money. I do, however, on a second breath, blame them for making it so complicated that we have, obviously, an analyst out here that doesn't understand this stuff. Why are you making it so complicated? Now, you talked about remote desktop service, CAL. There are two basic scenarios which trigger the requirement for an RDS CAL. The users or devices directly or indirectly access any of the RDS product functionality. Okay, or the users of devices directly or indirectly interact with the graphical user interface of the server software using RDS functionality or other third-party technologies, such as Citrix, Graphon, 2X, to name a few. Now, that brings something interesting to you. We spend all this money. There's a lot of companies that spend a ton of money on Citrix. And they spend a ton of money on Citrix. And when they spend all that money on Citrix, what you believe is, okay, that's all I got to put Citrix on there. And I looked at Citrix and they told me, okay, well, you got to buy all these remote desktop client access licenses. I said, wait a minute. Well, if I'm doing that, I'll just use RDS, right? Why in the world would I use Citrix? Citrix does give you a beautiful interface. It keeps your users off, you know, where they shouldn't be on your servers, and it's a great product. I'm not knocking them, but the pricing structure is unbelievable. Unbelievable. All right. So we come down here. I'm just going to go over a couple more of these. Do I need a client access license when my Windows Server used to run a web server? Windows Server 2012 R2 is configured to run web workloads. Do not require a client access license or external connectors. Folks, can you imagine that? Can you imagine, okay, everybody that comes to my website, I got to pay for a client access license. How would you even judge that? So that is a great call by Microsoft. We don't have to worry about buying them for that. Can I use my client access licenses to access someone else's server? You may use client access license purchased by your company to access your server or servers owned by your affiliates only. Remember, we just talked about this a little bit earlier about the licensing structure. Your affiliates, not people that you're affiliated with. You know, that's a gray area. So if for instance, I have clients out there, which I have about six different clients that I work for. So I go out to their networks and they're my affiliates, right? To me, an affiliate is somebody that you actually work for, like a company, like an affiliated company. One company is affiliated with another. I don't know. So that's another gray area. I would have to read into that a little bit and play around with that. But I live by one point in my life, and I've been doing this a long time with servers. Whenever in doubt, purchase the access license. If you're in doubt and you think you're in a gray area, like maybe it is, maybe it's not, to be on the safe side and to keep your butt out of prison, you know, you don't want to go to federal software prison because I heard it's not a nice place to be. You may just want to have your company buy the client access license, so you would be covered with that. Do I need a calendar, CAL? Do I need a client access license for my administrators? Now, this is something that gets a lot of companies in trouble. A lot of people I worked with, a lot of people I consulted with on their servers run into this. So they set up a server, and let's say they set up a back-end software package, whatever that is. Let's say it's the Mickey Mouse Club package, software package, and you want 10 users to access it. You set it up, you get it all running, and you first allow the first user log into it, and you're like, okay, seems to be working. Well, let's get one other user logged into it. You get another user log into it, and you're like, oh, it's working great, perfect. Okay, we're done with this project. Let's move on. What's happening there is the server allows you to have two client access licenses for free. So you can have two simultaneous people logged into there, usually administrators, and it's usually for doing stuff like, you know, working on the server, putting users in a user database, or in Active Directory, or working at DNS, whatever. So you have access without buying any client access licenses. That's pretty important. But what people don't seem to understand is just because two people worked, you get that third or fourth person on, you're going to be getting phone calls. Hey, I can't get in. I don't know what's wrong. What's wrong with this new software you said? You said it was ready to go. Because then you have to buy client access licenses. And, you know, we've purchased them. I usually buy them. I try to buy blocks because I never know how many more users I'm going to have accessing that server or how many people are going to want to access that server. So I try to buy blocks of, I would suggest if you have 10 people that are ready to use it and you think you're going to have a little growth, you know, just buy a block of 15. Then you don't have to go in there later and add 5. I mean, you have them. So that's a way to think about that. So hopefully we kind of clarified some of this stuff tonight. I know it's a ton of stuff. I'm going to put these links in the show notes, folks. I didn't really write elaborate show notes. Anybody listening to the show knows that Jack doesn't. I don't have a wiki space like Mike does. Mike has some contributors that helps him with his wiki stuff, and because he's a busy man also. But I do put the links in with the show, so if you're pulling it from iTunes, you'll see it. If you go to my website, tipsfromserveroom.com, you'll see the links there, and then you can click on those and read over this stuff. It's very interesting. And unfortunately, Jeff, you're probably still going to need a little bit more education around this. I try to give you some of the highlights and what I believe in. A lot of people work in that gray area with Microsoft Office. With any software package, if they put it on their server and they give people remote desktop access to it and it works, most people don't buy client access licenses for everyone because they believe when you buy that CAL, we talked about any third-party software or anything should be licensed. But most people believe when you buy that CAL and you're getting to that desktop, anything on that desktop should be available and usable to them without buying extra licenses for the software. So, but again, it's a gray area. I mean, do I think the Microsoft software investigating team is going to come knocking on your business door? Probably not. I don't think that's going to happen. If you're kind of like I am, though, I like to keep licensing logs. I like to keep things tidied up and say, because we keep track of, if I buy 10 Microsoft Office 2013 licenses and I put those into a database, and as we distribute those, we write down what computer they go on to. Because then if we're ever audited, I can pull down and say, look, this is what we did, this is where our software is, and this is who's using the software. And when you retire that machine, I do take that software back because we zero the machine out. I don't give the machine away with software. So I can get that license back into our own network and we can reuse that again. So, you know, but activating Windows Server and activating Windows 7 or even Windows 8 now, I'm sure, it looks at a lot of components in your computer and hardware. And a lot of times they'll tell you it's already been activated on a computer, even though you zero machine. Microsoft doesn't know you zeroed that machine. And then it'll say you have to call. And generally, if you call them up and tell them, look, I put this on a new hardware, they will generally, Microsoft will reactivate it. But it's a phone call and it is a pain, but they will reactivate it. So hopefully I gave you enough information about licensing your software and stuff out there and licensing your servers. And it is a daunting task, but it's something that we have to do. Jeff, thank you so much for giving me the show tonight. I want to thank so much to Josh and to Martin for the voice messages tonight. It definitely brings the show up to another level, and that's where I've been trying to take it to ever since I started it. Because sometimes me sitting behind this mic as you're driving, I may be putting you to sleep like, there's Jack talking again. I'm starting to go to sleep. But, hopefully I bring you the information you're looking for. And got a lot of great listeners out there. Again, I'm very humbled that you tune in each week and download these shows. Thank you so, so much. If you want to help these shows out, please send $1 million to my email account. No, don't do that. Don't send me any money. But folks, if you're going to buy from Amazon, and I know there's a million podcasters out there trying to get your Amazon dollars, I say spread the love around. You don't have to buy everything from my link, but if you buy some things from it, it definitely helps me out. I mean, I've never seen a payment from Amazon, because Amazon, the way they work is until you hit $100, they won't send you a payment. I've never seen a payment from Amazon. I've been giving out their link forever on multiple podcasts, on multiple YouTube videos, and I just never seem to get people to go there. And I got to admit, sometimes when I buy things from Amazon, I forget to use my own link. So go to tipsfromserveroom.com, turn off your ad blocker, right? Turn it off. Just say, I don't need this for Jack's site. Jack's site is safe. I'm not going to put anything on your computer. And look at my Amazon link there, and you say, hey, I'm going to buy a new book. I'm going to buy new running boards for my truck. Click on that link and use it, you know, and it's not going to cost you any more money, and I get a few dollars back. And I would like to see a payment this year. I mean, I got, what, 3 more months to get that built up to $100, so maybe I get a $100 payment. Because, folks, what they say is it's true. Podcasters don't get rich. And if you're doing a podcast and you think you're doing it for money, now is probably the time that you turn off all your gear. And you do what Mike Smith always talks about. It's called, I think he calls it pod fading. You're going to fade away. Your podcast is going to fade away into the darkness, because we're not here to make money. That's not what these podcasts are for. These podcasts are to spread the love and the joy of something we like doing. And folks, I love computers. I love networks. I love servers. So I'm just spreading the joy. And again, I just do it because I want to do it. And I enjoy talking to you. My joy, my payment, is your voice messages and your emails. That's my payment, and it costs you nothing to do that, right? Just a couple seconds of your time. Now, folks, with that said, though, if you want to learn Windows Server 2008 R2, Windows Server 2012 R2, or VMware ESXi 5.5 from install to administration, then please sign up for one of my server courses or one of my online courses. Go to tipsfromtheserveroom.com, look at the online class link at the top of the page, click on that, and pick out the course that you want to sign up for. These courses are very low priced, and I got a ton of feedback every week. I get emails, why is your courses so cheap? They must not be no good. And then I get emails from the people taking the course saying, Jack, how come you don't charge enough? You should charge more for this. I always tell them, you could pay me more if you want. They never offer it anymore, but that's okay. So, you know, you get both sides, but it is what it is. I work full time at this business, of doing, networking and stuff. And I have many clients out that I work with. So this is not where I make the money. This is just something where I'm paying it forward, and I'm giving you a very low cost course so you can learn it also. Check those out. Once you complete it, I will mail your certificate. So again, sign up for those courses today at tipsfromtheserveroom.com. Folks, as I say every week, I hope you have a great work week, if that's at all possible. Hey, it is Tuesday. We only have, 3 more days to go, and then you're back on the weekend. Take care, my friends, and I will talk to everybody once again next Tuesday night right here. Same channel, same bat time at tipsfromtheserveroom.com. Thanks, folks. I'll talk to you then. Bye-bye now. You just listened to Tips from the Server Room with your host, Jack. If you have any questions, please drop me a comment at tipsfromtheserveroom.com. Thanks again for tuning in and downloading the shows. Now sit back, relax, and listen to the remainder of the music. We'll see you next week on Tips from the Server Room. So long.